And then when an organism eats that plastic, it then is exposed to those chemicals.
Dr. Karen Kidd has been Jaroslawsky Chair of Environment and Health at McMaster University since 2017. Before that, she was a Canada Research Chair on the Chemical Contamination of Food Webs at the University of New Brunswick and a research scientist with Fisheries and Oceans Canada. Dr. Milena Esser is a postdoc in Karen Kidd's lab, and Colleen Wardlaw is a PhD candidate. We'll link to the Kidd lab at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post our complete conversation. You are listening to the GPM, the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Fixed on Gaza and the genocide Israel-USA has been committing there. Israel has been steadily consolidating its colonization and annexation of the Palestinian West Bank. Since the Gaza genocide began, 10,000 indigenous Bedouins have been displaced from their communities up and down the West Bank and in the fertile Jordan Valley. Another 30,000 have been forced from their homes in the so-called refugee camps of Jenin, Tulkarem, and Nur Shams in the northern West Bank. With the full support of Israeli soldiers and police, in and out of uniform, Jewish settlers, in and out of uniform, have forcibly displaced the entire Bedouin population between Ramallah and the Jordan Valley. Over 60 communities have been completely erased, eliminated, a clear war crime, arguably a crime against humanity. The GPM spoke about the ethnic cleansing of West Bank Palestinians with Fatih Nimer. Nimer is Palestine Policy Fellow of the Palestinian Policy Network, Al-Shabaka. We reached Fatih Nimer in Ramallah. Hello, Fatih Nimer. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello, David. Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Can you introduce yourself, Fatih? Tell me who you are and where you are and what you do and a little bit about Al-Shabaka.
Well, my name is Fatih Nimer. I am the Palestine Policy Fellow for Shabaka, which is the only Palestinian transnational think tank. We have over 200 members and we focus on policy.
Now, you've just published, Al-Shabaka has published a piece by yourself. This was published earlier this month, The Future of the West Bank Settler Takeover and Annexation. And you write here, since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023, land seizure in the West Bank has shifted from creeping settler encroachment to a vicious military-backed campaign of territorial theft. Can you talk about this? Tell me what's going on in the West Bank, and your focus in this article is the Jordan Valley, but can you stand back from the Jordan Valley a bit and talk about what's going on in the West Bank for a moment?
Of course. I mean, I chose the Jordan Valley because it's one of the most stark examples, but this can be seen all over the West Bank and before 2023 as well. Usually what happened is that the land seizures in the West Bank were accomplished through a combination of methods. Usually they wait for the army to come in and say this land is confiscated, it's shut down, and they get orders from the court to make sure that everything is bureaucratically correct for the land seizures and all that, according to, of course, Israeli military law, not anything to do with international law. But it seems that after October 7th, these pretexts have completely melted away. There's no need for them anymore. And the settlers just go ahead and seize whatever territory they want. They build outposts, which are naturally protected and built, supplied with all the resources and army protection and connected to the hubs and the roads and all that. And they just say that this is now a new settler outpost, which is a core of a settlement, which will grow into the big settlements that we know in the West Bank that control the vast amount of the territory in the West Bank. So before this, it was a kind of combination of both, but now there's no need to kind of legitimize this whole land seizure through these kind of legal orders that were so popular over the last 40, 50 years or so.
And I was standing back from your own article, I was reading something in DropSite that's just been published, that in the central Jordan Valley, running between Ramallah and Jericho, the Jordan River, over 60 Bedouin villages have been totally expelled and erased since 2022, most of these since October 2023. And so between Ramallah and Jericho, there are no more Bedouin villages. They've all been erased. And this is on top, and so 10,000 internally displaced people in the West Bank, entire villages, on top of 30,000 who were expelled by the Israeli military from Jenin and Tul Karam and Nur Shams refugee camps. This massive campaign of ethnic cleansing going on in the West Bank, isn't there? And in your answer, if you could quickly summarize the distinction for those listeners who aren't familiar with this, how the West Bank was divided up under Oslo into areas A, B, and C. Areas A being the populated Palestinian areas, and B and C being other areas, C being the lion's share. Talk about this distinction.
Sure. Through, as you mentioned, through the Oslo Accords, the West Bank was split into three kind of jurisdictions. Areas A, which is under complete Palestinian control, and that's basically the Palestinian urban areas where the majority of the Palestinian population resides, talking about big cities, Ramallah, Nablus, Hebron, and so. There is areas B, which are under Palestinian civil control, but Israeli military and security control. So it's a bit of a hybrid situation. And area C, which is the vast majority of the West Bank, around 60% of it. It's very sparsely populated. It's completely under the control of the occupation, both for civil and security affairs. And these are the areas which the settlement movement has been colonizing for decades. And this is the area where most settlements are constructed. And nowadays, they're also starting to move into areas B, by the way, because nobody stopped them in area C, and they're taking over most of area C. Now, what happened between the road from Ramallah to Jericho is that we're seeing the birth of new outposts. We're seeing new settlers. They're calling it now like nomad settlers or grazing settlements, which have basically settler shepherds who claim huge amount of land to say these are their grazing grounds now, and nobody else is allowed to go there, which locks Palestinians out of their villages. And they took over actively all the Bedouin communities' grazing grounds where nobody's allowed to go there. Of course, they're protected by the military. And slowly over the last 2 years, these outposts are popping up more and more, and the Palestinian communities there are being attacked more and more by these shepherd settlers and also their allies in other regions. And it's become impossible for these families to live there. So if they been for all intents and purposes kicked out and ethnically cleansed. And this is not just in Jericho. We see this in Hebron. We see this in all these areas which are majority C and are on the periphery of the West Bank, which is not close to any big population center. And it's only going to get worse if it continues this way.
And this is a reign of terror, like when a Palestinian, a Bedouin village gets displaced. First, it gets systematically harassed. People get attacked, assaulted, and then they get driven out. And this isn't just a bunch of bad apples in the settler movement. This is the settler movement as a whole, and they're fully coordinating their efforts with the Israeli military, aren't they?
Yes, it's completely open. I mean, we can't really make a distinction between settler and, you know, state violence in this case. They're both part of the same parcel. It's not about bad apples. It's all part of the same system. In this case, it seems like it's been subcontracted, the colonization of the West Bank, more and more to the settlers that go out of their way and do whatever they want. They attack villages, they burn down mosques and houses, and of course, who's the law enforcement in that area? Supposedly, the Israeli occupation army, who is obviously not really there to protect Palestinians. They don't follow up on any investigation, even if all the right, you know, procedures are taken and you present the proof of this attack to the occupation authorities. Nothing comes of it. It's almost impossible to get any kind of, you know, legal process going to protect yourself. And that's by design. We don't expect that an Israeli military, dictatorship over Palestinians in the West Bank is going to give them any ounce of justice. But this doesn't mean that there's no law. It means that the law just works against Palestinians, not against the settlers. Because if a Palestinian defended themselves, they'll find themselves in jail or even worse from these settler attacks in their own house, in their own territory. And this has happened multiple times.
And they collaborate, don't they, the settlers and the army? I mean, you've got settlers in and out of IDF uniform.
I mean, a lot of the IDF soldiers are settlers to begin with. I mean, settlers in the West Bank sense, not settlers overall, which I consider them. But it's they know what's happening, they know what's going on, and it's not that they turn a blind eye, they actually encourage it. They don't see Palestinians as a human, and they see all this land as their promised land that they want to kick everybody else out of. And this is a way that they can do it without much scrutiny nowadays, because understandably, not much attention is being given to the West Bank, but that provided the perfect cover for more and more terror.
So how exactly do they work together, settlers and soldiers?
A lot of the times when these settlers attack villages, they're being escorted by soldiers. If a Palestinian tries to defend themselves in any way possible, the soldiers intervene and beat up the Palestinian, shoot the Palestinian, arrest the Palestinian. That is if the settlers don't do that themselves. The soldiers allow the settlers to come and go as they want. They control the roads. They control the checkpoints. They know that settlers are attacking Palestinian villages, but they don't stop them because, again, that's not why they're there. And if there's any kind of accountability, they block it. Again, through the courts, they claim always that there's no evidence, even if it's on tape, it doesn't matter. So it's not that the soldiers and the settlers are kind of, because the impression is that the soldiers are trying to keep the order, but the settlers are unruly. That was like the narrative for the last few decades, but that's not the case. That's never been the case. They're both part of the same system. The settlers help the soldiers in the way that their soldiers, they have to maintain some kind of plausible deniability that they're following the law, etc. But even that evaporated. Even that evaporated after October 7th. And now the soldiers and the settlers can see, roaming the streets while the soldiers protect the settlers as they terrorize Palestinians. They burn down their houses. It doesn't matter. It's not, there's no kind of accountability in any shape, way, or form. And it's known. It's very well known who these people are and what they're doing. It's just, why would they even like lock them up? They share the same objective of as much land as possible, as few Palestinians as possible.
And in theory, the West Bank is governed militarily by COGAT, the Coordinator for Governance in the Occupied Territories, COGAT, which is an arm of the Israeli military. But now authority over the settlements has been handed over to the settlement councils, which are under the jurisdiction, the control of Bezalel Smotrich, who lives himself, he's a settler, he's a member of the cabinet, and authority over settlement development has now essentially been handed over to the civil authorities. Talk about this.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's a big shift of the status quo. I mean, usually the idea of these settler councils is to kind of run the administrative tasks inside settlements themselves as they grew in number. But now they're being given more and more power and responsibilities over Palestinians, which was something that was only in the hands of COGAT. So instead of you going to apply to COGAT for a permit to build, for example, a pool in your own house, or I mean like a rain catching pool, not a swimming pool, for agricultural purposes, you go now to the settler council to apply to that, which the COGAT already rejected almost over 90% of all, permit requests. If you want to expand your house, if you want to dig a ditch, if you want to do anything, you're not allowed to touch anything in your home unless you get a permit for it, which is impossible to get. Of course, settlers don't need those permits. And if they do, they get them very easily. But now you have to go through these settler councils, which very openly say that Palestinian presence is a threat to the Zionist project on their website, very proudly. So these numbers went down from 90% rejection to 100% rejection. And it's getting worse and worse. It's going to start going into areas B and A in the future, I would imagine. And it's impossible for Palestinians to kind of maintain any life. If you have children, you can't build them a home, even if you own the land. If you want to expand your house, you're not allowed to expand your own home. You're not allowed to dig a ditch. You're not allowed to build a wall around your land. You're not allowed to use heavy machinery on your agricultural land. So they make life as difficult as possible for Palestinians to force them to leave. And then they say, well, they didn't get a permit. And the permit is impossible to get by design.
Settlers talk about their desire to establish sovereignty over the West Bank, over the Jordan Valley and the entire West Bank. And yet anybody who's crossed over the Jordan River, over the King Hussein Bridge, the Allenby Bridge, knows that you've entered Israel. You get an Israeli stamp, you get an Israeli immigration slip, and you've now entered the state of Israel for all intents and purposes. The West Bank has been fully and entirely annexed in all but formal legal name. And yet settlers talk about the need to establish sovereignty. What are they talking about when they say, we've got to establish sovereignty over the West Bank, when everybody knows that the West Bank is sovereign Israeli territory?
I mean, it's de facto annexed. It's not de jure annexed just yet. They want it to be a part of the Israeli state, as simple as that. They want it to be completely 100% as Israeli as any other, cities within 1948 borders that they consider Israel. It's not enough for them to be the lords of this land. They also want it to be official, recognized. They want their army there. They want everybody there to speak Hebrew and to be. I don't know what they plan for Palestinians, if any of them are even allowed to remain. It's not enough for them to be in this state of exception where they're ruled by some military law in the West Bank as if they're not inside 48. They want it all. They want everything. They want to control everything. They want the idea of a Palestinian state to die completely. The idea of self-determination for Palestinians needs to go out of the window. And that's just the beginning, really. That's what they mean, sovereignty. They just want to be, they want the whole idea of Palestinian self-determination to be expunged, really, from any kind of future prospects. So these new civilian employees of these settler camps. This is the difference now. It's not just the military. Now we have civilians, settlers, that are coming and, bossing people around, telling them what to do. And this is one of the more kind of underappreciated aspects of the de jure annexation that's coming of the West Bank, is that now a lot of the military kind of responsibilities have been transferred to civilians who come and inspect Palestinian lands and intimidates Palestinians, really.
Tell me about what this intimidation entails for a Bedouin village in the Jordan Valley or somewhere, on the western side of the valley, not far from Ramallah, when settlers come in with their ATVs and they start with harassment. And tell me how this proceeds exactly and what happens to members of these communities. And they've got large herds of sheep and goats.
There's really no single template. Every area has its own kind of intimidation tactics. More and more, there's drones that are used to come to Palestinians' farms and farmers and kind of spy on Palestinians, intimidate them. Like I said, when aid is distributed to these villages, they come and inspect the aid, see what was kind of take inventory, and the aid is stolen within a few days of these visits, usually. It's they challenge Palestinians to do anything about them when they come and take. For example, there's a story about a settler who came and stole the goats of a Palestinian farmer. And he called the police and told them, Palestinians stole my goats, and these are my goats. And the police come and enforce that order without any kind of, even a pretext of an investigation, which, of course, we understand that as occupation law. It's not real law. So they can do whatever they want to any Palestinian anywhere. And only when a Palestinian kind of tries to defend themselves, that's when they bring in actual shooting and the killing and the violence and the arrests. In some case, there was a case where the settlers came to a village. They raised the Israeli flag. They said, if anybody lowers the flag, we're going to kick you all out. Just like that, they can intimidate and do whatever they want. And if anybody does anything, the army gets involved and often arrests, tortures, shoots, whatever, the Palestinians there. There's nothing that they can do about it. This is just how it has been for the last 2 years. That's why thousands of Palestinians have been kicked out of their homes, because it's simply not safe enough for their children. It's not safe for them to live there. It's not safe for them to go to work, to go to school. They don't know if they're going to be able to return home at the end of the day because of all the checkpoints. And the soldiers have been extremely malicious and in their way that they've been treating Palestinians, even more so than usual.
In the past, I've traveled with members of the Palestinian Jewish Israeli solidarity community to some of these villages like Al-Alja. I've been there, and I've been to Susia, and I've been to a number of these locations. where it was relatively easy to go there and you could go there and spend a day and have a meal. But it's becoming increasingly difficult for people who support these communities to actually travel there and to go there. Can you tell me how this has evolved over the course of the last couple of years, actually being able to access these villages and help them out?
Of course. I mean, over the last couple of years, transport between even Palestinian cities has become incredibly difficult. Even at the height of the Second Intifada, we have not seen this amount of checkpoints and this amount of control of the roads. It's becoming very, very difficult to even plan your day, even if you work 20 minutes outside of your village or your town. But from my own personal experience, we have a small farm that's only 25 to 30 minutes away. But if they close the checkpoint, it takes an hour and a half. If they close two checkpoints, then it's over. You can't get there. And this combined with all the difficult economic situation makes it really impossible for Palestinians to go around their normal daily life. This is much, much worse in these periphery areas like the Jordan Valley or the Hebron Hills. Often the entrances to villages are sealed with dirt mounds, forcing villagers and citizens to take kind of dirt road routes outside of their own villages that also the army knows about and closes whenever they want. We have these mobile checkpoints that are not within the official checkpoint count that can be whenever they want it to be, wherever they want it to be. Just areas where you don't even know that there's usually a checkpoint. There are new gates, so many more gates, gates for every community where they can just lock it and you are basically banned from moving. So these are just on the main roads. But even inside these communities nowadays, where there's a very real danger of new outposts being set up. And if a new outpost is being set up by settlers, it becomes de facto an area that you cannot really reach easily because they control everything in the whole surrounding area, not just in the little outpost. In the village of Atara, for example, a settler came and set up right basically in the middle of the village. And now that they get more and more settlers every day and they have army support and they have all these kind of amenities by being connected to the Israeli network of resources, and it's impossible to move in the all times of the day in all areas of the village now. It's just how it starts. And then it gets worse and worse progressively until that whole area becomes, you know, under the control of the settlers. And most Palestinians are forced to leave if they want to live any kind of normal life.
And these settlers, they enjoy all of the rights and privileges and services that any Israeli, Jewish Israeli living in Israel proper enjoys. They're connected to the water supply. They're connected to the power supply. They receive services.
And they get more. They receive more than the average Israeli, because what the Israeli government has done, it designates settlements as national priority areas, meaning that these are the areas that need more support to grow. So, for example, in settlements, you can get generous subsidies on if you're taking a mortgage, for example. And oftentimes, you don't even have to pay most of it. It'll get paid by the government. We get covered by the government and by donations from abroad. If you're an educator, because they want to encourage teachers and such to move to settlements, you get more salary than if you're a teacher, for example, inside the Green Line. So it's not just that settlers get all the same things that Israelis get. They get more because they're encouraged to move there, because the whole system is using these settlers to colonize as much territory as possible. This is state policy. It's quite open. It's quite naked for the eye to see. It's not even hidden anymore. It's just very straightforward colonialism encouraged by the state, which is why these little sanctions on individuals will never actually do anything, because it's the whole system is what encourages it, not individuals.
It's apartheid.
I'd argue that apartheid is one tool, but it's worse than apartheid. Like, it's settler colonialism that utilizes apartheid in some ways and utilizes other colonial methods in different ways.
But some would say, like John Dugard and various other former special rapporteurs on the situation in Palestine have said, that the form of apartheid that Israel practices is actually worse than the South African prototype.
I mean, I don't know about worse or better. Like, I don't know how to quantify that, but it's a very malicious form of apartheid. And again, it's only one tool in the repertoire of settler colonialism that Israel employs. in the West Bank and Gaza, because every area has its own context. It has its own little, toolkit of domination that gets used against Palestinians. So within 48, it looks different than in the West Bank. And people are really stuck on these kind of little distinctions between every single area. But if we zoom out a bit and look at it from the river to the sea, it's much worse than the South African model in some ways. It's much more bloody, that's for sure. I mean, Gaza alone is basically.
Tell me about the solidarity movement, the Jordan Valley Solidarity Movement.
Well, it's a grassroots movement that aims to support Palestinians in the Jordan Valley and to help them stay steadfast in their land. For example, if a house gets demolished, they try to get them another way to rebuild their house. Or if they get they try to get them water to their agricultural crops. They try to get them all these things that they need to stay steadfast. But being, a grassroots movement, it's not exactly as well, supported as the settler movement. So it's difficult for them to kind of stand toe to toe against what's going on right now. I mean, they are helping people as much as possible, but their resources are very finite and they're up against the well-oiled colonial machine that has been going on for decades and decades and receives donations from all over the world in different ways.
Is the Palestinian Authority providing any support or assistance?
The Palestinian Authority has no real authority in Area C. I mean, I'd argue in Area A as well. It's more of an administrative structure rather than a sovereign kind of, structure. They are trying to, with what meager resources they have, they are trying to give some real support to these Jordan Valley villages. Not all of them, just ones on the front lines, really, the most of them. But again, this aid gets stolen very easily, very quickly. There are so many cases of, after this aid was given to a village, the settler council would send somebody to go see what the aid was, and within a few days that it would be stolen by settlers. And of course, who are you going to call? There's no police. There's the Israeli army, which doesn't care because they know who stole it and they supported who stole it. So this is kind of like the vicious cycle that Palestinians live through, that seems like there's no escape really from any kind of ethnic cleansing program.
And the role of the Jewish National Fund and the World Zionist Congress, the World Zionist Organization, Zionist Israel supporters in Europe and North America and Canada.
Yeah, they have all these wonderful donations that are, tax deductible that go towards these projects, and which is one of the like a huge kind of source of money for these settler movements. And these movements, ever since like before the establishment of Israel, and they've been adamant about supporting. Even the tree planting campaigns were done to hide the Palestinian destroyed Palestinian villages after the Nakba. They only lease land to Jewish people. Even if you're an Israeli citizen, you're not entitled to lease land from the JNF, for example, because it's explicitly for the Jewish people, which is the majority of land in Israel between the government and the JNF. That's the majority of land that you're basically de facto not allowed to lease or rent if you're non-Jewish. Their role is, of course, very negative. They have all these donations towards the most racist organizations, anti-miscegenation organizations, all these things. It's naked colonialism that's tax deductible, and it's still going, which is one of the biggest tasks, in my view, of pro-Palestinian people in the West, is to challenge the status of these organizations and how they are complicit in the breaking of international law very nakedly and very clearly. And they don't even hide it because nothing's coming of it. There are no consequences.
Fatih Nimer is Palestine Policy Fellow of the Palestinian Policy Network, Al-Shabaka. We'll link to Al-Shabaka at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post a video of our complete conversation with Fatih, which went on quite a bit longer than this particular audio version. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong, and to GPM contributors Janelle Litan and Nathaniel Provost. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at cfmu.ca and greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Blueberry, and TikTok, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.